This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3679 for Thursday, the 8th of September 2022. Today's show is entitled Linux in Laws SIE, Nonprofits in the US, A Closer Look at IRX. It is hosted by Monochromic and is about 36 minutes long. It carries an explicit flag. The summary is the ins and outs of IRX.
Linux in Laws, a podcast on topics around free and open source software, any associated contraband, communism, the revolution in general, and whatever else fancies your tickle. Please note that this and other episodes may contain strong language, offensive humor, and other certainly not politically correct language. You have been warned. Our parents insisted on this disclaimer. Happy Mum! Thus, the content is not suitable for consumption in the workplace, especially when played back on a speaker in an open plan office or similar environments. Any minors under the age of 35 or any pets, including fluffy little killer bunnies, your trusted guide dog, unless on speed, and cute T-Rexes or other associated dinosaurs.
Martin, how are things?
Hey, Chris. Things are fine. Apart from everybody has COVID, but yeah.
Sorry, I think it's called Rona, no? Maybe I'm wrong. I think it's either COVID-19 in contrast to 20 or 21, I can't remember, or it's Corona, SARS, whatever. I keep forgetting. Anyway, it's
that one, yes.
Pretty much like politics or bad weather. And before I forget, this is, of course, Linux in Laws, Season 100, Episode 2758. We changed the numbering scheme about a fortnight ago. If you want to catch up on the previous episodes, feel free. Of course, the website is linuxinlaws.eu. You will find the full back catalog on that website. But this is not about missed episodes, Martin. How are things over there on the almost green isle?
Oh, it's very green.
Also known as the kingdom.
It's very green, yes. How are things? Interesting. Something happened.
Yes, Martin. We are recording this on the 4th of July, year 2157, I think. July 2022. But as a matter of fact, we're recording this on the 4th of July. Which is, funny enough, something called the Tax Independence Day, originally named that is, and something called the United States of America, now known as the Independence Day.
Yes. It obviously wasn't the United States of America back then, but yeah.
I mean, looking back, why did people go for independence to some extent, not just to some extent, okay. First and foremost, it was about religion and all the rest of it, as you normally do. But then things happened in Boston Bay and all the rest of it, and tea was apparently thrown into the water. Didn't make a huge difference from a taste perspective, I suppose, because we're looking at, what's the word I'm looking for, seawater, right?
Boston is on the East Coast, yeah.
Exactly, so never mind the faint taste of tea, it didn't make a difference. Didn't last either, so, but what did last is actually the independence. You can find the details in any history book worth its money. But given the fact, Martin, that that the key, as in the K, is heavily on the decline from a kind of in the broader political view of the world, I don't think that the US is going back to a British colony anytime soon. Maybe I'm wrong.
Probably not British, but some other candidates, right?
Martin, I hate to spoil the fun, but Russia never was a British colony.
No, the other way around. Yeah, yes.
You mean that Russia will also invade the UK? Sorry, the kingdom. Unlikely, because
we're talking about the US being independent, right? So,
this
will come to an end at some point. So.
In terms of what?
No, in terms of being no longer independent, whilst they are overrun by some country.
Like what? Canada? Mexico? Unlikely.
Unlikely to be Canada. Well, to be fair, they are probably. I don't know how big the Mexican population is, but it is quite.
But you see, the thing is, basically, it's better be a NATO state, because otherwise the fifth, what is it called, paragraph will apply. Not pleasant. So, if for any people who are thinking about invading the US, just from the theoretical perspective, please make sure that if you want to do this, you do it from a NATO member state only. Because otherwise, you will have the full force of NATO right against you. And that's not something that you want to do. Unless...
Most NATO countries have about 5 tanks. Something to worry about.
Mr. Putin, if you're listening, either you are not exempt from this clause. So don't even think about it.
Yes.
Okay, but this is not a show about independence or invading the US from a NATO member state or not. This is actually one of the most important episodes we ever did.
Mm.
Especially if you're suffering from insomnia, very important. Only the episode I reckon on floss licensing comes second, because this episode will actually be on 501Cs. Go ahead.
No, carry on. You said 501C. I thought you said 501 jeans.
No.
I may have done the wrong preparation.
No, 501Cs are a special type of organization in the US only, I might add.
Uh-huh.
Especially relevant from a tax and other and some other perspective. But as we will touch upon in about 2 hours, maybe 2.5 hours time, once we have laid the foundation for the following discussion, quite a few open source and civil rights movements are filed or are classified as 501Cs.
Uh-huh. So
this is why it may or may not be important, because we had the Electronic Frontier we had parts of the Electronic Frontier Foundation on the podcast. We already had the FSFE on the podcast, which is, of course, the European sister organization of the Free Software Foundation. And, of course, we also had, not exactly in the order of priority, or never mind importance, Loris, if you're listening, we had also our beloved Loris Crowe on the podcast, of course, representing the Zig Foundation. And the Zig Foundation, if you recall, Martin, classifies as a 501c6.
Uh-huh.
But before we go into the level of detail, we should probably first and foremost put a disclaimer in. We are by no means lawyers.
Yeah,
we are by no means tax consultants.
I think the appropriate phrase is far from it.
Yes, exactly.
Anyway,
every tax consultant similar to marketing that we get in, Martin fires immediately. So so no worries. So
we have no income, so we don't have to worry about that.
Anyway, so the following, of course, comes with the usual caveats. Please seek professional help in these areas, if you are seriously thinking about setting up a 501c, whatever subtype applies. Please, as I said, please do get professional help. Links may or may not be in the show notes. And, of course, consultants, if you want to sponsor something called Linux in Laws, your email address is sponsor@linuxinlaws.eu. But without further ado, maybe before we go into the differences about 501Cs, we should probably explain the type of organization that a 501 a 501C generally is.
Before we do that, we should probably say what it is. Right?
Please, Martin, go ahead.
Well, so a 501C is an American or US tax code that looks is specifically for tax exempt organizations in some way, form, or shape. Think about your charitable organizations, your education type organizations, and software foundations who have non-profit goals, things like that.
You just mentioned a very important term, non-profit, because mm-hmm. most, if not all of these organizations, depending on their level of tax skills, do not make a profit. But before we go into the details, there's one important difference. There are non-profit organizations and not-for-profit organizations. Martin, sorry, you want to explain the difference here?
Yeah, so the non-profit organizations are organizations that don't make any profit. And the not-for-profit organizations are organizations that don't want to make profit. But yes, you feel free to expand on that.
No, spot on. Non-profit means basically their income comes mostly from donations, charitable ones, I might add, whereas the not-for-profit organizations typically have some additional source of revenue. And the main difference, if common law is anything to go by, normally not-for-profit organizations typically make some sort of tiny margin on their revenue, like anything between 2% and 5%. Whereas typically non-profits do not make any margin. And of course, the margin being basically the difference between the cost charged for services and goods rendered and the cost, the original cost of these services and goods in general. This is known in the trade typically as a margin, as in the difference between stuff you buy. And that, of course, also applies from the services rendered by your labor force and the price at which you then sell any goods resulting from the combined efforts of the services and goods originally bought. Mm-hmm. This is typically as called a margin in the trade.
Is it? Okay.
Yes. Very much so. If my economy 101 knowledge is anything to go by, it dates back to about 30 years back or something, maybe even more.
Okay. So fine. So we've defined that. So what about the people that work for these organizations and get paid for this?
I would call them nutters, but that doesn't capture it, I reckon. No, from a taxation perspective, you're looking at typically employees, right? I mean, people are employed by the business, so yes, they would be tax liable. Unless, of course, they donate some of their income back to the employers, which, of course, then, depending on the type of 501c, would be tax deductible.
Well, that may as
well. Yes, Martin, indeed. But no, I mean, nutters is probably the wrong term. We're looking at people with strong ideals.
Yes.
Very important.
Okay, so don't they have things like state laws in the US as well?
I think 501c, if memory serves correct, is a federal tax regime.
Right. So let's say California could decide, oh, let's tax these guys anyway.
No, they couldn't, because they would be violating IRS as Internal Revenue Service guidelines, under which all these associations run.
Guidelines can be ignored.
Sure.
No, but I'm sure in the
Texas US, tried, have, but Texas failed,
have,
right?
You have multiple taxes, right? You have federal tax and state tax, I'm sure.
Yes, Martin, but you see, the IRS basically is on the federal level.
Yes. So yeah, this is state, what I mean.
State stuff doesn't apply.
So this 501 stuff only applies to the federal level. So you don't pay federal tax, but then, as I mentioned, California can say, oh, we don't care about your 501, so you pay his tax anyway. So you need to choose the right state as well. No?
I reckon this is where our lack of tax knowledge in the US comes in. Tax accountants, whatever, tax people, if you're listening.
Specifically tax accountants in the US.
The email address is feedback@littlesinlaws.eu, especially to quell Schmartens thirst for knowledge on a local state level in the U.S. when it comes down to Texas.
Before we go into too much detail, why don't you give us some examples of organizations who have set up under this or have successfully applied for this exemption? Martin,
before we do this, we should probably give a short overview of the different subcategories involved.
Could be. Okay.
I reckon it would make sense, right? So there's the umbrella term 501c. That is, of course, a federal IRS
level. Okay. So what are A and B?
And then you have subcategories ranging from 1 to 1, 20,547.
What about A and B? What are A and B?
Oh, you got me there, Martin.
I don't know. It's like, what, there must be an A and B.
The loophole is basically that this episode is aptly titled 501C. So yes. Only the C applies, not B, not E, not D, not the A.
Okay.
But people, if you're not asleep by now, Martin just promised to do an episode on 501A
and B.
Exactly.
Yeah. This may take a few years to materialize.
Exactly. Yeah. No, jokes aside, as I said in the beginning, we will get to examples in a minute, but why? And that also will explain why is this important from a U.S. perspective. So. The thing is basically that if any IRS website is anything to go by, we are looking at about 29 subcategories under 501c, ranging from 1 to aptly 29. The most important things that apply to the, and now we're getting back into the context, apply to the FLOSS world and to FLOSS communities would be 501c3. And 501c6.
Okay.
And Wikipedia says...
Do these have a name, these 3 and 6?
Yes. Wikipedia talks about religious, educational, charitable, scientific, literary, testing for public safety, to foster national and international amateur sports competition or prevention of cruelty to children or animals organizations. That would be the 3 for you. And 6, apparently, business leagues, chambers of commerce, real estate boards. Just a couple of examples for these two subcategories. Mm-hmm. Now, what is, of course, important, if we take a look at the Free Software Foundation, if we take a look at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, these are typically examples for 501c3s, because they would fall into the scientific / educational
Apache Software Foundation, Mozilla.
Same thing, yes. Mozilla, C3s. Yes. Whereas a 501c6 would be a trade association, typically the Linux Foundation, for example, which is, funny enough, filed as a 501c6.
Okay.
Because as probably we all know, those of who you are listening, the Linux Foundation is an enterprise body of the community on an enterprise level using Linux. And now is the time as any to probably go into some of the details. Characterizes, especially 501c3s.
Okay. Oh, sorry, what was the question?
It's not a question, Martin.
Oh,
it's
okay.
More like a further characterization of a 3. Before we go into the Fair sixes or the sixes. If anybody's still awake.
Okay,
so
let's go.
Exactly. So, for example, the IRS also differentiates between a public and a private foundation for a 3. And the difference is basically that the income for a public foundation actually comes from the public, whereas a private foundation is powered by investments and endowments. And that makes a difference, basically, if you take a look at where your moolah actually comes from.
Mm.
Also, the important difference between a 3 and a 6 is actually that if you donate to a 501c3, mm-hmm. these donations are tax deductible if they're charitable. And I reckon with the Electronic Frontier Foundation and with the FSFF, they would all classify as charitable, all right. Also, something important for a C3, these bodies are typically prohibited from supporting political candidates there's something called a Johnson Amendment dating back to 1954 that exactly prevents this or prohibits this. So if it becomes too apparent that you're supporting a political candidate, you could lose, or you could risk to lose your 501c3 status, meaning then you are liable to taxes and some other implications.
And the C6s have to report their political involvement as well, in terms of money and stuff.
Yes, but I reckon if you're running a trade organization, and a C6 typically is such a trade organization, you can do a certain amount of additional lobbying. And more specifically, I mean, there's nothing in the code that prevents a C3 from doing some subtle lobbying, I reckon.
We're talking about donating to political campaigns, right? That's
correct, yes. So, yeah. That means supporting political candidates, exactly, because that would classify
as a candidates campaign, with money, in other words.
Exactly.
Yes.
So these are some of the main differences between a C3 and a C6.
Yeah. There's a few other ones as well.
Martin, please go ahead. If people are listening, I don't know.
Who knows? So your C3 can't receive any grants, for example, whereas your C6 can. They have to report any donations over $5,000, whereas the C6 doesn't. So all sorts of fun like that, really.
So word of advice, if you want to launder $1 million through a C3, you want to split this up.
In many 4,000.
Exactly. Like pretty much like a Bitcoin Tumblr, that sort of thing.
Yes.
So that you are flying under the radar, and elegantly, I might add.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What else?
Before we come to the floss context that we already kind of touched upon. Yes, churches, 401c3s, yes. These typically also include religious bodies. So, Richard M. Stallman, I don't know if you're listening. Of course, Richard M. Stallman being the Richard M. Stallman, also known as the St. Ignatius of something called the Church of Emacs. Here you go. Yes.
What's wrong with the eye, anyway? Yeah. Right.
much. Or a lot, let's put it this way. Well, one of the things that... it's not wrong with VI, is actually that I think they're Emacs emulation modes.
Uh-huh.
Excellent. Progress is being made. So if the FSF wouldn't be classified as a 501c3, at least the Church of Emacs could go for this from a theoretical perspective.
What are they?
Church of Emacs. It's essentially a church.
No. What state are they?
What do you mean, what state are they?
Well, do they have an C3 or a C6?
Not yet. No, that's what I'm saying. Right. Richard, if you're listening, this is your way out.
they don't get any money either. They haven't bothered.
Well, apparently, certain Mr. Stallman has joined the FSF board recently.
Again,
yes. Details maybe in the show notes. But I'm not too sure what happened afterwards. We touched upon this, by the way, during the FSF episode.
Yeah.
And for those few listeners who missed out on this, details are, of course, available in our back catalog. So, Martin, now is probably the time, as good as any, to touch upon why this kind of makes sense from a FLOSS perspective at all.
Yeah.
Especially if you happen to be a US resident or want to set this up in the US. Because if you're thinking about setting up the next software conservancy, software conservatory, or setting up the successor of the Free Software Foundation or something like this, more than likely you are targeting the US because of money.
Well,
maybe you're not.
Well, I mean,
If you're not targeting the US, you can stop listening right now.
Yes.
If you're targeting the US, please listen on.
Probably be a completely different number in each country for these kind of things.
Exactly.
But the principle is probably fairly similar.
Yeah. Thing is, basically, the point that Martin and myself here are making is you want to choose your subcategory wisely in terms of if you are slanting towards civil rights like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, or have more community aspects in your focus. The C3 is probably something you want to go for. If you are more like a trade party representation, like an industry body or something like this, it's the six. Yeah. It's the thing you want to go for.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
From a Frost perspective.
Mm. So yeah, if you're more interested in let's say, educating people around open source, then the C3. Probably would go for a C3.
Yes. So for those of you who are still listening, need to say any questions? Any questions? Feel free to send to feedback@linuxinlaws.eu.
What about legal?
Martin, if you haven't fired them, they may still be around.
Yes.
Needless to say, we're not lawyers. And Martin, and as Martin has fired again our legal department last week or something, we are not in a position to give legal advice. But we will do our best to answer any of your questions coming our way, given our limited capacity on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, jokes aside, this was meant to be a very short overview anyway.
Yeah. So the quick, fact,
yes.
Yeah. Sorry, can I finish what you're doing?
And then we'll... I mean, given the fact that we're clocking in at what 30 minutes, I reckon, already, or 28 or something like this. Yes. Right. Any poxies?
Oh, yes. 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 What's it called? Hang on. What is it called? Anyway, so I'll tell you what it's about first, and then I'll tell you the name.
Absolutely.
So Channel 4. I was just doing this Channel 4.
What's Channel 4? What is Channel 4?
Channel 4. Channel 4.
I thought they went bankrupt about 10 years ago.
No,
you're
not
talking about the TV channel, are you?
Yes, the channel.
I thought they went bankrupt.
No.
What? Are serious? Are they still around? Amazing.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, so on Channel 4, they have a new series called The Undeclared War.
The what?
The Undeclared War.
Undeclared War, okay.
Which is set in 2024, where GCHQ, that's in the British intelligence people, prevent some cyber attacks and stuff like that by some foreign nations of unnamed origin. And it's quite amusing, really, if you watch it. So, but it's also quite, as a story, it's quite good. So, well,
okay.
The technical details probably leave it a bit to be desired, let's put that way. It's quite nicely done. So, you can overlook those.
Okay, what's my POX then? Bear with me. I just have to dig up the English translation for this.
Ah.
Yeah, it's a famous German dish.
Sauerkraut.
No, Martin, it's not.
Bratwurst?
Far from it, actually.
Kartoffel. What else? Kartoffel, Bratwurst, Sauerkraut.
It's a form of dumpling called in German der Wiettenknödel.
How much?
For some reason, yeah, Google made a failed attempt at it and called it napkin dumplings, but you cannot translate it, of course.
That's a good name.
No, actually, some American website actually calls it Serviettenknödel. It's a dumpling, essentially.
Okay.
It's very tasty, especially if done with a mushroom sauce or a mushroom topping. So, and I came across this about the other week when I had to cook for a relation of mine that's currently not able to cook. Details will not be in the show notes. But suffice it to say that I've taken over now the role of an almost professional chef in that capacity.
Okay, well, in that case, I shall expect some Kartoffelpuffer and some...
Martin, dream on! Let me dig up the
homemade
reserves. Yes. No, jokes aside, we're talking about my mother, and my mother recently has fallen ill. The role model of a son that I am, I stepped in, of course, and we switched roles. Now she's sitting at the table, and I'm cooking for her. And this is the reason why I dug up this beautiful Wiettenknödel recipe. Details will be in the show notes. It's a down to earth German speciality. essentially you're looking at a dumpling made from old bread, as quite a few dumplings made are, for example, the stuff you get in Bavaria, called Semmelknödel, as a matter of fact, which literally translates into dumpling made from bread. And I topped this off with a sauce made with fresh mushrooms and some cream and some spices and herbs. And as usual, that was both our favorites, I reckon. So yeah, this is the reason why this is now my pox of the week, as in the pox, the pick of the week, exactly. Mm-hmm. And as I said, a recipe will be in the show notes so that Martin can surprise me with his cooking skills when I'm visiting him next time.
Well, clearly you will be served with a British dish.
Oh, fucking dear.
Accompanied by lukewarm beer.
Oh, dear. No, Martin, in that case, please, please, please go for your Dutch origins. Okay, we don't have any feedback. This is the email address is still the same, feedback@linuxinlaws.eu. So if you have any feedback, people feel free to send this to that mail address. Be cool. We haven't heard from you in ages. So if you're still listening, feel free. Luna, was that her name? The Debian person? We're still missing your feedback too, literally. But any other people, feel free to get in touch. And with that, we would like to thank you for listening. As usual, our hearts go out. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Very important. People, HPR is about to redo the website.
Ooh.
Yes, and they, being an open source project, they are looking for volunteers. Details may or may not be in the show notes. You'll find actually some of the core discussion on the HPR mailing list. HackerPublicRadio.org is your go-to source for this. So if you know any data... Martin, you come from a database background, no? If my research is correct.
Yeah,
they're looking for SQL people.
Are they?
Again? Yes. I already volunteered to do the API part. So okay. People, jokes aside, if you have some spare cycles and if you're looking for a very cool project to contribute to, check out the mailing list. Simply subscribe to the Hacker Public Radio mailing list and stay tuned. And as usual, it's an open source project that is worth contributing, not just in terms of coding, but also in terms of simply providing content. So like we do, like some other hosts do. So if you think about doing podcasts, this is your platform. And now, Ken, I didn't say podcast hosting platform. I simply said platform. This is the important bit, right? Jokes aside, hey, HPR, as usual, thank you.
This is the Linux In-Laws.
You come for the knowledge,
but stay for the madness.
Thank you for listening.
This podcast is licensed under the latest version of the Creative Commons license, type attribution share alike. Credits for the intro music go to Blue Sea Roosters for the song Salute Margaret, to Twin Flames for their piece called The Flow, used for the segment intros, and finally to Celestial Ground for their song Sweet Justice, used by the Dark Side. You find these and other ditties licensed under CC at Jamendo, a website dedicated to liberate the music industry from choking copyright legislation and other crap concepts.
I have a quick fire 501 general knowledge question for you.
So, go ahead, Mark.
HTTP 501, what does it mean?
Do not know. Can't recall. It's probably probably in server error or something.
It's not implemented.
There you go.
What about SMTP 501?
Martin, you are the SMP, the expert for all of the two of us, so don't bother me with that stuff.
Okay, you got 0 points so far.
Fair enough.
Okay, what about area code 501 in the US? Which states is that in?
Oh, no. Why did we all of a sudden switch to pub quizzes? We were on the subject of 501 C's, Martin.
Oh, I thought we finished with that. Okay.
Martin, what does 501 mean in Klingon? Same question.
Or these
two languages that they speak on Bytegoes or something. Martin, go ahead.
Okay, if someone says 501 to you, what's the first thing that you associate it with?
$501, as in $501? Buy you a cup of coffee, current inflation rates going.
Yeah, probably. Now, I mean, it could be all sorts of things, like, depending on your upbringing or context. So,
who?
If you were to live in Arkansas, it would be a phone number code. If you were If you were a fan of darts, that would be a darts answer. If you like your jeans, it would be Levi's, right? So, and if you were into HTTP or SMTP, it would be some error codes.
Levi's, if you're listening,
and of course,
a sponsor at linuxinlaws.eu.
Not to forget the Fiat 501. Which was
Cinque Uno, that's right.
Yes.
That, of course, reveals the fact that Martin is almost as old as I am, because 501s were popular in the 70s, if memory serves correct.
No, that was the 500. The 501 is actually a lot older. It's from the 1920s.
Really? Okay.
Yes. so they went backwards in numbers, I guess. I don't know.
Okay. People, you heard it first. Martin is officially not older than I am.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HBR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.